It's Wednesday, April 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, convention delegates are driving the road to the White House.
It would be in accordance with their previous behavior because winter is now turning into spring in Afghanistan.
It's that time of the year the spring Taliban offensive begins. Also ahead, stronger cooperation between the United States and India. The FBI may have a photo of you. Good news for fans of Tigers and Game of Thrones, all on today's International Edition. The U.S. contests for the Republican and Democratic presidential nominations have turned into contentious fights for delegates to both parties' national conventions, where the candidates for November's national election will be picked. Billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump is the Republican frontrunner, but he said Monday that party officials have created a crooked system to keep him from winning a first ballot victory at the party's July convention in Cleveland, Ohio. While Trump has won the most state-by-state nominating contests, he is well short of a majority of convention delegates needed to claim the nomination. Trump's ire was aimed at weekend voting in the western state of Colorado, where his chief rival, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, collected all 34 of that state's national convention delegates at a political meeting confined to party activists and not voting open to the general public as in other states. At the moment, Trump, a brash one-time television reality show host, has 775 of the 1,237 national convention delegates he needs to claim the Republican nomination. That's compared to 545 for Cruz and 171 for Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who has dropped out of the race, another 143 for Ohio Governor John Kasich. Urged by supporters not wanting Trump to be the party's nominee in the general election, U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Paul Ryan on Tuesday said he would not run for the White House, a development VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone discussed with International Edition host Michael Lippin.
I think for some time now, Paul Ryan's name continually came up as a possible alternative should the Republican convention in July become deadlocked. And I think what Ryan has said is it's becoming a distraction for him. I mean, he is the Speaker of the House. He has a congressional agenda to kind of lead and put forward and try to implement. And it was becoming clear that even on a recent trip to Israel, he was overseas, and he said the interest in the U.S. presidential election was really something for him. And they were asking him constantly if he was, in fact, willing to be a candidate. And I think he reached the point where he had to say, which is what he said today, I'm out. You know, he thinks anyone who is chosen ultimately, even if it's not Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, but whomever the Republicans eventually pick, should have decided to run for president. It shouldn't be someone who did not run for president.
Now, why do you think Paul Ryan faced these, you know, kinds of endless questions?
Well, you know, it's kind of part of the narrative that's put forward, especially by the anti-Trump forces in the Republican Party, that if they can deny Trump the necessary delegates on the first ballot, the 1,237, there may be more than one ballot. There'll be multiple ballots. And the longer that goes, no one from the current crop of contenders, that's Trump, Ted Cruz, and John Kasich, maybe could emerge. So perhaps then the convention would look to an alternative, a dark horse, as it were. This is something that happened in our past, by the way. It's not without precedent, but not in the recent past. But I think Ryan realized it was a total distraction for him from the agenda he wants to promote.
And I guess he wants everyone to move on from from that idea. Well, in terms of moving on, we've got a big primary in New York State in exactly a week from today. What are the candidates doing to try to get an edge there?
You know, they're hitting various parts of the state where they think they have the best chance to secure votes and in the end win delegates. Certainly the two home field contenders, and by that I mean Republican Donald Trump, who's from Manhattan, and of course Hillary Clinton, who represented New York in the Senate, by the latest polls are doing well. Both have double-digit leads right now. It's looking pretty solid for them. On the other hand, Bernie Sanders has a home field link to New York. He was brought up in Brooklyn. But Sanders, again, faces the same issue where you have a large, diverse state like New York with plenty of minority groups and voters who are key in the Democratic race. And Clinton seems to be doing very well with those groups, especially African-American and women over, say, the age of 45. These are her areas where she's very strong. So the latest polls show that both Trump and Clinton may be poised to make a comeback because they've had some recent setbacks. And that again, would reset the race a bit toward the presumptive front runners, Trump and Clinton, as we look toward the party conventions.
Well, thank you very much for that roundup. From Jim Malone, VOA's national correspondent. Great to talk to you.
Same here. Thank you, Michael.
Well, turning to social media, International Edition's G. Abby Lee stops by Studio 22 to let us in on the conversation via the internet. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What's the trending hashtag on Twitter at this hour?
Apart from sports and entertainment, hashtag Equal Pay Day is the number one globally trending hashtag. The hashtag is aimed at raising awareness of the discrepancy in pay between men and women.
Right. Now tell us a couple of the tweets.
Sure. They're both from Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's on Twitter at SenWarren and tweeted this. I cannot believe we are still standing here debating whether a woman should get fired for asking what the guy down the hall makes. Her next tweet is, hashtag Equal Pay Day isn't a national day of celebration, it's a national day of embarrassment. Although both of these tweets got almost 2,000 likes each, some people replied the salary and pay decision should be made by managers and not influenced by government officials.
Equal Pay Day has been something that has been recognized for about 20 years now, so
right.
This has been going on for some time. What are some of the other trending stories?
A high-level U.S. official, House Speaker Paul Ryan, is also a trending topic at this hour. He has two accounts on Twitter, one for his role as a Speaker of the House, at Speaker Ryan, and another one at P. Ryan for a more personal use. He sent out a tweet about not running for presidential nomination. He shared a link to his statement through the latter.
What does it say, and what's the reaction like?
It's a very long-winded statement, but basically he wrote, he believes that if you want to be the nominee, you should have actually ran for it. One person who is a Trump supporter, judging by her Twitter handle, applauded Ryan's decision as being thoughtful. Another person wrote, it may not be Paul Ryan they try to put in, but they do have dirty tricks up the sleeve. Now I'm assuming that person is probably referring to the Republican National Committee. Last but not least, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos is also trending. That's because more than 13,000 Amazon customers signed a petition to ask Bezos to stop selling Donald Trump's line of menswear. Jim?
Thanks for the analysis, G. You may follow her on Twitter, at G. Abby Lee. I post there as well, at VOA Stevenson. And our International Edition stream can be found at VOA_IE. The Afghan Taliban has announced the start of its annual warm weather fighting season. The group vowed to carry out large-scale attacks against government strongholds through suicide bombings, as well as attacks on NATO troops still deployed in Afghanistan. International Edition host Sarah Williams speaks about this with Ben Berry, a retired British brigadier and the senior fellow for land warfare at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London.
It would be in accordance with their previous behavior, because winter is now turning into spring in Afghanistan. There was, certainly in the later part of last year, there was less of a reduction of Taliban activity than previously. You know, maybe they were seeking to press their advantage with the Afghan forces, and also that their new leader, Mullah Mansour, was seeking to establish his authority over the force.
Yeah, now this comes just in recent days. Over last weekend, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was in Afghanistan, and the Taliban, you know, set off an attack, which it did not affect him, but they said that was in response to his visit.
Yes, well, they would do, wouldn't they? I mean, I don't think we should read anything special into that.
They've made a point of, you know, naming this after the late Mullah Omar. Is there any special significance in that, or is this just to honor him?
Yeah, I think it's that. You know, there are plenty of examples of armed forces naming offensives after famous victories or famous leaders. I mean, it may also be an attempt by Mullah Mansour to reinforce his legitimacy, because you could argue his legitimacy was knocked when it was revealed last year that Mullah Omar had in fact been dead for 2 years.
As far as you know, I mean, as far as outsiders would know, has Mullah Mansour been able to consolidate his leadership of the Taliban?
Well, I think there's little doubt that he has done. And indeed, you know, the fall of the temporary fall of Kunduz last fall, you know, would have been a great boost to his leadership.
Ben Barry, Senior Fellow for Land Warfare at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter told a New Delhi news conference on Tuesday that Washington and India have agreed in principle to share military logistics, but that a formal agreement is still not to be finalized.
Today, we agreed in principle to share and exchange logistics, as has already been noted, which will allow us to do even more.
Well, most of the sharing comes in the form of basic technology and some larger items, such as the way aircraft are handled on carrier ships. Traveling with Secretary Carter, VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb in New Delhi tells us the cooperation also strengthens military capabilities amid growing potential threats.
India hesitates to say anything too negative about any of its neighbors because it doesn't want to cause controversy. But I was speaking to senior India defense officials on background who were telling me that, yes, China is concerned. One of them even said that their biggest threats were China and Pakistan, their two neighbors, which is something you don't hear too often from Indian officials in public. You hear that in private, but they try not to go on the record about that. The actions in the South China Sea have been very concerning to everyone in the region. India feels pretty confident with its relationship to all of its neighbors and even to China. They do a lot of joint exercises in the South China Sea with China, but they also want to make sure that that relationship with the United States is strengthened. That was something that was pointed out several times during the discussions between the two defense ministers, talking about how these agreements and technology that are coming between the United States and India, those agreements are something that no other ally that the U.S. has. They're very unique to India. Secretary Carter even saying that some of our closest allies, like the United Kingdom, didn't even share quite all of the same agreements. So there's a lot to come.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb from New Delhi. As the third Asia Ministerial Conference on Tiger Conservation got underway this week in New Delhi, the Global Tiger Forum and the World Wildlife Fund announced the world's tiger population appears to have increased since 2010 to nearly 3,900 as of 2014. That's compared to as few as 3,200 6 years ago. It appears to be the first reversal of declining numbers since an estimated 100,000 tigers roamed habitats worldwide. Darren Grover, National Species Manager for the WWF in Australia, tells VOA's Victor Beatty via Skype the increasing number of tigers known in the world is a result of a couple of developments.
It is a reflection of the comprehensive surveys that have taken place in a number of the tiger range states, particularly places like India, Nepal, Russia, Bhutan. So we're getting a really good understanding of exactly how many tigers are in those countries. But a lot more accurate, a lot more precise. It's also a reflection of some of the fantastic on-ground management work that's taking place. A great example of that is the work that's gone on in Nepal, which is into its third year now of zero poaching of tigers. So it really demonstrates the commitment of the Nepalese government and the Nepalese people to protect tigers.
So how serious is the poaching issue regarding tigers?
There's really three key issues as far as tiger conservation goes, and poaching is one of those issues. There are still problems with tigers being taken from the wild and their body parts ending up as part of traditional medicine in markets throughout parts of Asia. So it is still a problem, and it is still occurring. The other big issues are habitat loss. We're seeing in places like Sumatra in Indonesia, large areas of tiger habitat being lost to things like palm oil plantations and logging for timber. But then when you have that situation where the habitat of tigers is lost or it's fragmented, it means more people are coming into contact with tigers more regularly. And that might be tigers entering villages and taking livestock. And for those villages, having your goat or your calf is a very important resource. When that happens, there's retaliation.
On the plus side, you have a country like Cambodia that would like to reintroduce tigers.
That's right, and that's great to see. Cambodia has lost its tigers now. They are functionally extinct in Cambodia, but the Cambodian government is very keen to reintroduce tigers, and that's a great step forward.
Well, this report comes out and coincides with the third Asia Ministerial on Tiger Conservation in India. What do you expect to accomplish there?
There's two things we're hoping to see. One is that those countries that have committed to take surveys and other actions on tiger conservation, you know, stick to their commitments and follow through on them. But really a doubling down on the commitments of all the tiger range states to do the things that are needed to ensure that, you know, tiger populations are safe and are growing, and we're moving towards that target of doubling tiger populations in the wild by 2022.
Hollywood actor Leonardo DiCaprio is part of the conservation effort. He issued a statement calling tigers some of the most vital and beloved animals on Earth. And he said he's proud of the collective efforts to make progress toward increasing the tiger population, but acknowledged that much more work needs to be done. Computers are increasingly helping the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation solve crimes by matching suspect photos against what it says is the largest biometric database in the world. The technology, however, does not make everyone feel safer, as we're now joined by International Business Times senior writer Eric Markowitz.
The FBI has wanted to build out a biometric database for a very long time. Up until recently, really in the last decade or so, this has kind of been impossible. But now that there are so many avenues to collect facial information, really just through pictures, the FBI has basically created a database of not just mugshots, but pictures taken overseas in Afghanistan. Anytime a person applies for a visa from another country, that picture is taken in and housed in this FBI facility. And this particular facility is in West Virginia.
Is this database essentially for people from overseas who are coming to the United States, or does it also include U.S. citizens?
The database includes U.S. citizens. So definitely if you have ever been convicted of a crime or even arrested, you've had your mugshot taken. So the FBI has access to that photo. More recently, the FBI has started to contract with individual states to get access to their DMV photos. So when you apply for a driver's license and you go to the DMV and they take your picture, you may not have realized that you're essentially consenting to the FBI using your picture when it searches for criminals.
How does the FBI do this? When they're investigating into a case, are they looking at perhaps photos from surveillance cameras, that sort of thing, and trying to match it up against this database?
Right, exactly. So what the investigators can do is they can even take a picture off of Facebook. If they think that this is a suspect in a crime, they can take that picture and they can send it to this database. And that database will search against all of the other pictures that are in the pool. And it's right now around 500 million photos that exist in this particular database.
How accurate is the facial recognition technology at this point?
The reality is that it's not actually all that accurate. The FBI goes to great lengths to assure people that there won't be any mistakes, that no one will get arrested because of a mistaken identity. But the reality is that there is about a 20% error rate. And so it's a situation that I think law enforcement confronts pretty often, which is they have technology that might be able to help, in this case, to help in terms of finding a criminal, but it can also potentially lead to a very dark reality, which is they may be going after the wrong person. Some people may end up getting hassled by police if they happen to look like someone. So the technology works, but it's certainly not particularly accurate at this point. This was a program that cost the FBI $1 billion, if not a little bit more. They contracted with Lockheed Martin to build it. And I think the question that I think is a good question that many people may have is, okay, we've spent this money on a technology that theoretically makes us safer. The FBI has not really offered too many statistics on how successful this program has been. And so there's definitely some critics who say, this is a very expensive program. It no doubt raises concerns about privacy and who has access to these pictures. And the FBI can't really prove that it's been particularly successful. So why are we paying for it? And I think that's an interesting point and something that should be talked about when we're talking about not just facial recognition, but any wide-scale technology program that's implemented and used by police officers and FBI agents.
International Business Times senior writer Eric Markowitz, whose story you can find online, the FBI now has the largest biometric database in the world. Will it lead to more surveillance? Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Fans of the HBO drama Game of Thrones got a taste of the new season when episode 1 of season 6 premiered in Los Angeles. And as International Edition's David Byrd reports, fans can look for the leading women to play major roles in this coming season.
Are you afraid? You should be. You're in the great game now, and the great game is terrifying.
We are sent creatures. We deserve death. We all do.
If you've been watching Game of Thrones, let's answer the first question first. Yes, Jon Snow, the bastard son of Ned Stark, the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, is dead. At least that's what John Bradley, who plays John's best friend Samwell Tarly, said at the premiere of season 6 at the Chinese Theater in Los Angeles.
He is really dead. Sadly, he's really dead. And I know that people find that hard to believe. But you know what? I think that it's getting frustrating now, the fact that people, no offense, the fact that people ask the question, but I just think it shows how much we've captured the kind of public imagination with it. And people love that character so much that they don't want to believe it's true.
Fans of Thrones will know that shocking death is nothing new to these characters. Think of Ned Stark at the end of season 1, or The Red Wedding, or Prince Oberyn when he fought Gregor the Mountain Clegane. But John Bradley says even though Jon Snow is dead, fans will be satisfied with the way the story plays out.
But the good thing about getting the show on is that pretty soon all those questions are going to be answered. You know, I think people are going to be satisfied with the outcome. Not to say that I'm going to suggest it's one way or the other, but I think it's going to tie up in a way that's narratively and in terms of pace and stylistically very satisfying for everybody.
Sophie Turner, who plays Sansa Stark in Game of Thrones, says that fans can look for the women of the fantasy drama to take more leading roles.
But I mean, this is a big season for for women in general. It's a big season for all the characters, but this is really, you know, the women are very badass in this season. It's exciting. But I can't tell you any more than that.
Season 6 will also see Cersei Lannister, the one-time queen of the realm, struggle with the death of her daughter Myrcella and the consequences of her rage.
I think about locking Myrcella in a crypt. I think about her beautiful little face starting to close.
Don't think about it.
Lena Headey, who plays Cersei Lannister, says the show's writers have given the cast plenty to work with.
But this year in particular, Cersei's kind of beginning in this broken place and not sure of who she is, where she is. And then she starts with the news of the loss of her daughter. And this prophecy that she feared is starting to come true. So her unraveling is really beginning, even though we thought we saw it, you know what I mean? And she has to re-find her sort of place in the world. So it's really hard for her this year.
Emilia Clarke, who plays the mother of dragons, Daenerys Targaryen, was last seen being taken away by her one-time people, the Dothraki. Clark says that fans can look for Dany to emerge stronger in Season 6 as well.
The thing about Daenerys is she always lands on her feet. She always, like, you never need to really worry about her. Like, she's got a plan. She's got her eyes on the prize, and she's taking a turn for the badass this season.
Game of Thrones Season 6 premieres on HBO April 24th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can find us at our website, voanews.com, and on Twitter, at @VOA_IE. We pause for just a moment to remember our former colleague, Tom Crosby. We learned that he passed away, and before retiring 10 years ago, he hosted this very program, among others. You may have heard him if you've listened for that long. Our condolences to his family. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Daryl Smith. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry recently co-chaired the third meeting of the U.S.-Afghan Bilateral Commission in Kabul with Afghan Foreign Minister Salahuddin Rabbani. At the center of the U.S.-Afghan relationship, he said, is a shared commitment to peace based on security from violent extremism, coupled with a desire to promote prosperity and social progress in every province across Afghanistan. Both sides discussed the goal of launching peace talks with the Taliban. Secretary Kerry expressed U.S. support for an Afghan-owned, Afghan-led peace and reconciliation process and called on the Taliban to enter into talks that would provide equal rights and protections for all Afghans and bring an end to the violence and suffering that the people of Afghanistan have endured for so many years. Meanwhile, the U.S. remains committed to the mission to train, advise, and assist the Afghan security forces as they combat the insurgency and protect the Afghan people. The U.S. recognizes that Afghanistan cannot secure a prosperous future without continued support from friends and allies. NATO will discuss providing additional assistance at its security summit in July, and the international community will meet in Brussels to review development aid in October. Democracy requires credible institutions, said Secretary Kerry. It requires a willingness by people from different political and ethnic and geographic factions to be able to come together and work for a common good, adding, it's not just up to the leaders, it's up to the citizens to help shape their communities and their country. That and not more war and not more terror is the surest way to bring about stability and prosperity to Afghanistan. U.S. and Afghan leaders also reviewed the process of implementing the $800 million New Development Partnership. This initiative, said Secretary Kerry, will promote stability and accountability by linking funds to specific reforms that promote the rule of law, encourage private sector growth, and enhance women's rights. One of the great accomplishments of Afghanistan in these years has been the opening of opportunities for women. Today, there are millions of children in school, and fully a third of them are girls. That is an enormous step forward for the future of Afghanistan. We know that Afghans are going to continue to work to achieve further progress. That's something the United States has confidence in. We also know that the world stands with Afghanistan in this effort, and no country more so than the United States of America.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.